Mr. Evans, reel two. To come back to your childhood, Mr. Evans, what were the usual childhood activities growing up in the area that you the areas you were living in?
Yes, well, when I was three, we moved up to Blue Hall Estate, and most of the play was out in the street, particularly in summertime, and we had formed into gangs. There was an escrow, so these gangs had reputations. For example, the Greeter Road gang was supposed to be ferocious and formidable, and the escrow gang, which I was in, were rather polite and harmless. But most of the confrontations were just a matter of shouting at each other from a safe distance, and perhaps an occasional brick being hurled. That was the extent of the violence. As far as the games went, the girls used to play on their own, mostly skipping or ball games, and they'd have a skipping rope across the road, and they'd be able to play uninterruptedly for a long time because there's very little traffic. I know that my mother, there was a young man who lived in Greeter Road, had a Red Indian motorcycle, and he used to come home from work every evening, and about then my mother used to make me come in until he'd rode past because of the dangerous motorcycle. But most of the traffic was horse-drawn. The greengrocers, the firewood men, the rag and bone men, the coal man, the baker, the ice cream men, all horse-drawn vehicles. And one was used to come along, and it was in the form of a boat on this cart. And if your mother could find some old rags or woolens to give, you could have a ride up and down the street in this boat, you see. Or sometimes it'd come along and you could get a goldfish or a balloon for old clothing. Mr. Chilton, the cobbler, used to come around with a sack and say, "Have you got any shoes you want repairing?" And he'd put them in the sack, take them away, and then bring them back a few days later. But most of the men did their own cobbling. They nearly all had a last and used to buy a bit of leather, and it was much cheaper. The milkman used to come around in a milk cart, Mr. Riley, and he used to come round to the back door, and he'd have his milk pail with him, and inside there'd be a pint measure and a quart measure, a gill measure, and he used to dip it in and fill your jug from this measure, you see. He was a jolly sort of man. He said, "When I were a lad, I thought I'd never get 50. That is in the dialect. Because when you are a lad, 50 seems a long way off. But the lads used to play out. We used to play hide and seek, and a game called Monte Kitty, where we jumped on each other's backs. And we also used to go for walks across the vineyard in Thorpe Thewles, across the fields. And your mother would give you a bottle of water and some tomato sandwiches, if you were lucky. And off you would go for the day. Because nobody had any money, that was the point. Didn't feel badly, didn't too, because that was how it was.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about your family income, in the sense that was it sufficient? Were you able to live reasonably well on what your father earned?
Yes. You see, I was an only child. No family allowances in those days. And so I suppose I did reasonably well, because in the next door there was a large family. The father was a crane driver at the Malleable Works. And they used to think that I was very well off, because I used to have what they called cow's milk, in other words, fresh milk. They used to have skim condensed milk out of a tin, and I used to envy them, because I loved skim condensed milk out of a tin, because you're nice and sweet. And also my mother used to have butter, and they used to have cooking margarine, and once again I used to envy them, because they used to get a piece of a jigsaw with each pack of margarine that they've got, you see, and so they used to build up this jigsaw. And I used to sleep by myself at night. It was very dark upstairs, when I was 4, 5, 6. Very dark and lonely, and there was no light. The only light in the house was a gas bracket over the fireplace. So when you came in at night, your mother would have to light a match and then light this gas mantle. And in the dark, it was very easy to knock the mantle and break it. And you'd have to go around to the shop to buy another gas mantle, which was quite an expense. But there was no lighting upstairs, and so you had to take a candle upstairs. And then once I was in bed, and my mother would blow out the candle, and I'd be in the dark. And I know for some reason, one night, I stayed with this family next door. They called them Humble. I'm still in contact with them 60 years later. And I slept in this room, and there were three of us in the bed in a row, and another one along the bottom laid, and then there was a little, what we call a truckle bed, next to that with two more in. And I thought it was the best night of my life, that company and chatter and cheerfulness, yes. I envied them for that, and they probably envied me. But I had the best of food. They lived on the poorest of food. When we came home from school, my mother would make me some fry up or mince, whatever it was, for dinner. And you'd see Jim Humble next door and his sisters would go off to the co-op around the corner, come back with 3 pennyworth of what they call redskin, which is polony. And then you'd see them come out with a crust spread with this polony, and that was their dinner. And what used to irritate my mother was that I got everything that was going. I got chicken pox and mumps and measles and tonsillitis, and they never got anything. And she thought that wasn't fair because she always managed to feed me well.
Had the house an outside toilet?
No, there was an inside toilet. Downstairs, there was the living room. You went through into the kitchen at the back, and then you went through a passageway. There was a toilet on the left, coal house on the right. And then you emerged into the garden.
And was that a water toilet or a earth
toilet? Oh, yes, a flush toilet, yes. But there was no electricity. There was gas.
Did the church or chapel play a role in your family?
No, not really, because I don't think my father, after his First World War experiences, was particularly moved to go to church, organised church. He had his own thoughts about religion. He wasn't an irreligious man, but he wasn't for organised religion. But my mother took me to Sunday school. I used to go to the Wesleyan Chapel in Norton, and then later on I used to go to Sunday school at St. Michael's Church, which is the south of Norton, and there I gradually grew up, joined the youth club. We used to meet on a Monday night. That was the highlight of my week. Monday night went round to the youth club in Edgar Street, and you paid a penny and you spent the evening there. You could either play table tennis, or they had some rings hanging down, a pair of rings you could play on. Or there was a punch ball. The curate there used to play chess, anybody wanted to play chess. All simple pastimes, but that was our social life.
Did you get involved with the Boy Scouts or the Boy Brigade?
No. Our mother was a bit protective that way, and she was always afraid I'd fall in and get drowned or get pneumonia if I got wet. And... I didn't. I would have liked to have done. The only thing I was in was 1930, the Meccano Club. And that was quite flourishing. And that met in a primitive Methodist chapel on the way down to Stockton. And we were all Meccano enthusiasts, and we used to build models. For 1 week it might build a model bus, and next week it might build a model crane. We had competitions. Also Hornby trains we used to have. So that was the only club I was in, apart from the youth club.
Discipline in the home, how were you disciplined?
Well, in common with most other families, we used to get smacked quite a lot. My mother used to use a slipper, and she used to get carried away sometimes and slip me all around the room. I was a very quiet, sensitive sort of child, and I wasn't very happy about that. But a lot of the families, the father used to take the belts off to them. It was normal. And for example, if you did anything wrong at school and they got to know about it, you got another thumping from your father as well. Nobody ever went up to the school and complained. And similarly, we were very law-abiding. When we first got our bikes, we used to ride very carefully on the correct side of the street. And we didn't ride on the pavement because it was wrong. And we didn't ride after dark without lights on. And this was 1930, when traffic was very, very light. But we sort of were law-abiding in those days. We did what we were told, and there was no vandalism. The reason being, because there was punishment. You knew that if you did anything, if you damaged, say, a telephone kiosk, you'd be up before the magistrates, and you'd get 3 strokes of the birch instantly. Carried out downstairs and told now clear off next time he gets sick. And so, knowing what to expect, we didn't do it. In other words, we knew what was right and what was wrong. That was the difference.
You left school, you told me, 16 and a half, was that correct?
Yes. When I was 15, we, as I say, we all took the school certificate, 100% pass. And I was given the privilege of an extra year to take the Civil Service General Clerical Exam. So I studied for that, and we took it at Darlington. And I also went to Darlington to take the Oral French. And in due course, I was offered a job for the Inland Revenue, and it was in London. And I think it was about 30 shillings a week. But you had to pay your own travelling expenses, buy your own books, and pay for your own accommodation. And as it happened, the headmaster had said to me and one of my friends, John Sayers, who came from Sedgefield, you're going up to Newcastle for interview to the Newcastle Fontaine Savings Bank. Nobody said, do you want to be a bank clerk? What do you want to do? I just said, you're going. And so we went up, and quite an adventure for us going to Newcastle. We were interviewed by the actuary, Mr. F. Stanley Tollett, and asked some very, very simple questions, such as one was, what is cellophane, I remember. Very simple, because we were grammar school lads. And the highlight was we were given 2 shillings, tea money. And that was a small fortune in those days, 2 shillings, when your pocket money was perhaps threepence to sixpence a week. So that was the highlight. And so in due course we got a letter and I was told, you're starting in the Newcastle upon Tyne Savings Bank, Tubwell Road, Darlington. This was September 1936. And so that's where I went. And every day I used to get the number 24 United bus, take it to Darlington, get there 9:45. And the first day I very timidly knocked on the door. I was only small and timid person, and this big 6'4½ lad answered the door, very gushing, very pleasant, very overwhelming. He was called Jeff Lancaster. And he was 26. Of course, he was a man of the world, and I was 16 and a half, you see. And our hero worshipped him because he used to go out dancing at night, and he used to go to the George at Piercebridge, the George Hotel, and go wear a dinner suit. And he was, you know, a man about town, and he was sort of my hero. Because my life was very, very different.
And what were the conditions of work? You know, the hours that you worked?
The conditions of work? Well, there was a travelling time, but I got there 9:45, and I remember the routine now. A very strict manager, Peter Grant Munro, a Scotsman from Inverness, and I was frightened of him. I was 36, very stern, red-faced, but he was sort of mature 36. And John Sayers and myself both started a Darlington branch the same day and were rather insulted because we both had matriculation, school certificate with honours, and we had to spend the first day writing from 1 to 9 till we wrote it the way he wanted us to write it. And he would not allow us to sit down when we were at work. He said sitting down causes idleness, you see. So I had to stand all day. On a Monday morning, my task was open the windows with this long pole, wind the clock, change the blotting paper, change the nibs on the pens, fill the inkwells, test the fire, the burglar alarm. Underneath the counter there was a button. When you pressed it, it set the alarm going for 3 minutes outside. So I just did a quick test on that on Monday morning. And then I used to have to go down into the strong room, carry up the ledgers, which took a couple of journeys, big heavy leather ledgers it were, and set them out, and then open the safe upstairs and take the books out of there, and we were just about ready for action then. When the town hall clock struck 10, I used to go and open the doors, and that was it. We were not allowed phone calls. One of my friends had started work with the Eagle Star Insurance Company in Middlesbrough, and he called me one day, and did I get a rollicking from the manager for receiving a personal phone call.
And your work, after you'd done all these initial tasks, what did you do the rest of the day?
Well, worked on the counter, and the manager, Peter Grant Munro, used to stand watching us, and if we didn't speak pleasantly to the customers and say, isn't it a nice day, and thank you very much, he used to tell us off. He had to talk to the customers and make them feel valued, you see. So, and I learned a little lesson there. One of the customers came in, and he was a farm contractor called Stephen Luck. And my mother had been very fond of his son, also called Steve Luck. And I remember him coming to repair my grandma's house in this field at Cleasby Field House. And so when he came in, I was so pleased to see him, and I revealed who I was, you see. And the next thing was he came and closed his account. And I realised then that you've got to keep quiet. People don't like members of the family and friends knowing what you got in the bank. So we used to work on the counter, and then we used to, any new account was given an account number, and you had to write a ledger heading in the great big leather ledgers, and only Jeff Lancaster, the 26-year-old, was allowed to write the name and the occupation and the date of birth of the new customer, you see. And if you happen to make a mistake, you're not allowed to alter it. If you've made a mistake, Mr. Munro used to go to his desk and take out this ink removing kit, two bottles, and he used to take it out and carefully blot it, and then he would carefully put in the correct figure. And of course you got all over the coals for being careless.
What was your first wage?
Right, now my first wage was £1, and that was a very good wage at the time, because a lot of my grammar school colleagues went into local government, town hall, or went into solicitor's offices, or went to ICI. They went either as clerks or as laboratory assistants, and they used to get about 7 and 6 pence a week, which as you know is about a third of £1, so £1 was looked upon as a very good wage. My mother used to give me a shilling back out of that, and she used to say, you needn't think this is keeping you. So that's all I used to get there. And by the time the war broke out, I was 19 and a half, and I'd just been given a rise, and I was getting 35 shillings then, and my mother gave me half a crown back, 2 and 6 pence. And she used to say, and you needn't think this is keeping you, she used to tell me.
What were the hours of work?
The hours of work were very good. We opened the doors at 10 o'clock, we closed them at 3, and at 3:15, provided we got balanced up, I used to get the 3:15 United bus back to Stockton. On a Friday, I had to stay over, and we opened again from 5 o'clock till 8 o'clock, because we were a working man's bank, and it was for the benefit of working men could come in 5 to 8. And then on Saturday we closed at 12:30, but we opened again at 6 o'clock on Saturday evenings, 6 till 8, once again for the benefit of the working man. And I had to come back always from Norton to Darlington for that evening opening. And I always felt quite pleased when it got to about 7:30. The Darlington Salvation Army band used to march past it, a very big band in those days, and I knew at that time I was about to be freed, able to come home again.
Annual holidays. Did your family have an annual holiday as you were growing up?
We did have a week at Scarborough from the age of about 10. We managed to get to Scarborough for 1 week. And we stayed in a little place in Bedford Terrace, and it was number 3, and it was occupied by a lady called Mrs. Frith. She was an elderly, white-haired lady, very friendly, and my mother used to buy the food, take it in, and Mrs. Frith would cook it, you see, while we were out. That's how it went. And her husband had been killed in the First World War bombardment at Scarborough. Remember that? So I used to have sixpence to spend at Scarborough a day. So I used to have to make that last. That was for ice cream or anything, or any amusement arcades or anything. I loved the amusement arcades. And I used to find a machine which is so worn, it you have to knock these 3 cannon down. It's so worn that there was a groove just above each cannon, so you got the ball run along into the groove, and you pressed the button, and the slot went back, and the ball went down and knocked out this cannon. So you could knock all 3 out, and you got your money back, so I could play for hours on that one. But that was the limit of my spending. And we went there, and I remember coming back. We once got a cab from Stockton Station, and I'd be about 11 or 12 then. And Stockton Station was quite a bustling place then. It had branch lines to Ferry Hill and to Haverton Hill, to Whitby, of course the usual lines up to Newcastle and Northallerton and Darlington. And it had a W.H. Smith bookstore and first and third class waiting rooms. And why am I telling you this? Because outside there used to be a row of cabs. The cabbies there, sitting there with these long whips beside them, waiting for customers. We came back in a cab one day, and that was very posh for us. Because I remember when I came down Esk Road, I lay down on the floor in case any of my friends saw me and thought I was being posh.
So what were the leisure activities of a teenage boy in those days?
Teenage, right. Now, apart from the Monday evening club, social club, you've got to remember there was no television, and the cinemas and theatres did not open on Sundays. We had very, very little money, very little indeed. So our recreation was playing football or cricket in the recreation ground, or riding on our bikes. Our bikes were vital to us because none of us had any money. It was normal. It didn't feel badly done to. And on an evening, you could either ride to Darlington and back, Stokesley and back, Seton Carew and back. That was the limit of the range for an evening. And on a weekend, we'd set off, say, 7:30 in the morning, and you could cycle as far as Castleton, Kildale and Rievo Abbey, Thirsk, Barnet Castle. You had, that was about the range you could manage, and we spent lots of time cycling. Yeah.
1930s, war was coming then.
That's right.
When were you aware that this was going to happen?
I don't think we were aware, you see, because 1936, when I left school, we were always brought up that the First World War was a war to end all wars. We couldn't imagine that civilized people would ever sort of get into trenches again and start bombing and killing and shooting each other. It was finished. That was in the past. We were very law-abiding, very unaggressive, unwarlike young men. And we were all churchgoers. It was normal because there was nothing to do on a Sunday. So we used to go to Holy Communion on a morning, 8 o'clock. And you didn't have to have any breakfast. That was the big thing before you had communion. And my mother used to get so upset about that. You need something in your stomach, she used to say. In the end, we compromised. I had a banana. and she was satisfied then. And so communion at 8 o'clock, then there was the morning service 10:30, and then there was the Bible class 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and then there was evensong. And of course when our voices broke, we all joined the choir, so there were about 10 of us supposedly bass singers in the choir, along with a few older men. And that was Sunday routine, and after Sunday 7:30 used to come out, pitch black winter's nights, and we used to go up and down Norton High Street in gangs, no money, unaggressive, and the girls used to do the same. And if we ever met a bunch of girls, the sort of more daring ones would exchange a few words with the girls, and that was it. They used to call it pounding the pavements, or the monkey parade. But that's all there was to do. It was very boring.
As the war approached, you know, 1937-38, early 39, what indications were of any preparations hostilities?
When I was at the grammar school, we had a trip round Head Wrightson's engineering works, and I remember we went round the machine shop, and they were busy machining parts for bombs. That was the first time I realised that we were making armaments. Still didn't think there was going to be a war. And every night on the radio at 10:30, there was a dance band from 10:30 till 12. I was always very keen on music. And we got all the best bands, like Jack Payne, Jack Hilton, Roy Fox, Lou Stone, all the big names. Harry Roy used to be on 10:30 till 12. But round about 1937-38, we used to hear these speeches by Hitler. That we didn't know who Hitler was particularly, but he used to go ranting and raving on, and all this cheering, and we used to think, you know, what's he going on about? What's all this intensity about? We still didn't think about war. And then they started digging trenches in the recreation grounds, slit trenches, in case of bomb attacks, which we thought was a bit strange. And then young children were issued with these Mickey Mouse gas masks. So we still didn't think it was going to be a war. But looking back, the indications were all there, of course, but as young teenagers, knowing there was never going to be another big war, we didn't think it was anything to bother about.